Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 1st of July. We made it through halfway through the year. I thought it was touch and go there for a while, but we made it, and congratulations. So now we entered the second half, and, you know.
God help us.
In like a lion. I don't know. But July 1st, good morning and welcome. I hope you have a beautiful day today, and I thank you for spending some time with us this morning. It means a lot to us. We have just an outstanding group of individuals who are around our oblong amoeba-shaped table that is far from round, but that is okay. It's radio, and you just have to think of it as round.
That's curves.
That's right. It's rounded. There are some rounded edges. And we thank you for being with us, and we thank you even more if you would like to be a part of our program by writing to us at panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Let us begin by introducing the group. Bo Breslin is here, Joseph Palamountain Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, and good morning, Bo.
Good morning, Joe. I'm well, and I'm super excited. My wife and I are getting ready to celebrate the real Independence Day tomorrow, because, of course, that's when the colonial government agreed to independence, and July 4th has become our celebratory day. But July 2nd is the actual day we started as an independent country.
Will there be fireworks?
What's that?
Will there be fireworks?
In our household, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What were you saying, Sarah?
I said I love that for you both. That seems like a really quirky, like, couple thing. I love that.
She doesn't love it quite as much as I do, but I'm super pumped.
It should be on the dating apps. Like, when do you celebrate the independence?
I don't mean to take away from its very deep meaning, but it seems like kind of a cheap ploy to try to get another couple days off.
We have too many holidays, Joe.
Touche, Joe. Touche.
Fireworks.
We have to make, like, why just make it the 4th? Let's go from the 1st through the 5th.
Sounds good to me.
Happy
to
July,
be here, Joe.
Early July. That's very nice. Editorial in the Times Union over the weekend. Am I correct?
That is true. The Trump Constitution. I did it with a student.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, it was really great.
And how did this come about?
I was in a class with a student, and I was talking to her, and she said, "Why don't we consider what Trump's constitution would look like?" And so we generated through ChatGPT what a Trump constitution would look like, and we compared it to the American Constitution. And as you can imagine, Joe, it's a little bit different.
Good stuff. Find it at the Times Union website.
That's right.
And go from there. Speaking of the Times Union, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the TU, Jay Jochnowitz joins us. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning. And I will be I didn't know this. This is total coincidence, but I'll be dancing tomorrow. So that's sort of a celebration. So
absolutely. You go, Jay.
It's our last dance class for the
summer. Class. I thought you just said it was going to be
a little song, a little dance.
Yeah, a little seltzer down the pants. That's right. Go to it. Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, is with us. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm here.
It's really good to see you. Thank you very much.
It's really good to be
here. Thank you for being here. I know that in and of itself is accomplishment, and I thank you for that. Mike Spain, former associate editor for the aforementioned Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you on our program this morning. All right. So there's a lot going on, and we're going to talk about as much of it as we possibly can stomach and muster. So here we go. Republicans, this is the update. Republicans try to wrangle votes as the Senate debates a policy bill for the third day. Vice President J.D. Vance arrived at the Capitol prepared to cast a tie-breaking vote on the bill, but it was not clear when Republicans would call a final vote. This has been going on now, as I said, stretching into the end of the third day, and they're racing even this morning to lock down the votes to pass this tax and domestic policy bill after an all-night session of voting and negotiating with holdouts left. President Trump's agenda hangs in the balance. Debate on the package stretched into its third day as party leaders press to keep the legislation on track to meet Mr. Trump's deadline of enactment by July 4th. Good thing he didn't talk to Bo. All day, Monday and into the early hours of Tuesday morning, Republicans held firm against numerous Democratic efforts to challenge every element of the measure, particularly its cuts to Medicaid and federal nutrition programs, as well as tax cuts for the wealthy. And then, hey, don't forget, then it's got to go to the House. So there is that. Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, the number two Senate Republican, just left the Senate floor about 10 minutes ago. And sort of trying to be wooed. They have worked closely over the years and have similar energy issues in their states. But right now, voting is sort of paused. They're trying to basically, it seems that at this very moment, it's all about trying to get Lisa Murkowski to turn around. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. And let's see. Is there any other element to this? Well, we'll get to the trade stuff in a few minutes. But we will talk now about this particular bill and where it is and where it could go and what it means. And Jay, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, you know, a good place to start as any is probably Tom Tillis. I was just blown away yesterday when I read, actually heard an excerpt of his speech. I do understand, but I find it hard to reconcile that a person who represents his state could stand up and say, I am not going to harm 600,000 people. You know, he didn't put it that way. He said, what am I going to say to 600,000 people when they're kicked off Medicaid because Donald Trump lied, didn't tell them the truth, broke his word, whatever language he put it in. It is an extraordinary thing that when you stand on principle for the people in your state, you're not even going against the people in your state. You're standing on principle to defend them, to make sure that they have health care. And you are no longer a viable candidate. Mm-hmm. And you know that. You know that you're going to get crushed by somebody in an election, whether it's an Elon Musk who doesn't think you're good enough, so you're going to have to be primaried, or Donald Trump because you're not loyal enough. But we're at a bad place. And we have been for several years, for many years, actually, when representatives and senators stand up and say, I'm going to vote against the bill. And by the way, I'm not running for reelection because I'm terrified of being called names. I think the last 3 days of drama kind of all come together, that anybody who doesn't have either the lack of courage or the courage or this kind of combination of fear and courage that Tillis had to motivate him what he did. I think anybody who's staying behind is making that calculation that, well, I don't want to be on Trump's bad side, so I just have to make this just good enough that I can stand it and vote for it. They'll vote for it.
We'll talk a little bit later about just this idea of the exodus. I mean, we have two senators so far that are looking for the door. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Sarah.
I hate to make this about individual personalities because I think we do too much of that. Politics has become a sport in the country, and that's why this is entertaining, even as the actual impact of it is going to be pretty devastating for no one in this room, probably, and maybe most of the people who are listening, but by millions and millions of Americans. However, I'm not surprised that Lisa Murkowski is the holdout and the person who's sort of risen as a leader, small L leader in the Republican Party on this. I remember when she had to teach people how to pronounce her name. She came up with a really cool T-shirt when she was getting elected, right? Because she was a write-in.
Yeah.
And it had to be spelled correctly. And no one even knew how to pronounce it. And so she put, like, a picture. It was, like, phonetic. And then there was a picture of a cow for Murkowski. And I don't know why that has stuck with me over the years. But she always struck me as somebody who would do whatever it took in order to get to the answer that was right for her constituents, even if it meant some, you know, losing political capital along the way.
I was struck by two or three weeks ago, there was the piece in the New York Times, and they had this very striking visual of her, a video of just sort of almost literally wringing her hands as working through this of a tortured lawmaker trying to do the right thing. And so now it seems that that's the position that she is in. So jury's still out on that. But, Bo.
Joe, yeah, so give me the hook whenever. I've got a lot to say about this this particular bill. First of all, let me just be honest.
You hear British people talking, right. Shut up.
Okay. But if it's Moira, that voice, she can talk.
Take it away, Mike.
From the BBC.
I was speaking of the BBC, not of our CEO, just for the record. Right. Go ahead.
Bill is not good for America, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, healthcare cuts and increased taxes on the rich and so on. I want to talk, first of all, about the way in which the bill is not good for America and America first. This is the irony in the Trump administration with some of the other pieces to it. So taxing endowments on colleges will have a deep effect on financial aid for students. So regardless of whether you're Harvard or a lesser elite school, you're going to feel the impact when it comes to inviting students to join your community. The limit on income-driven student loan forgiveness program is going to have an effect on jobs and on college educations. America is the second leading producer and consumer of renewable energy behind China, ahead of Brazil. We are going to lose that position. What happened to America first, trying to get to be the first and the best, like the Trump administration says? Customs and border protection, billions and billions of dollars going for that. If this is the Trump administration, if the Trump administration is doing so well now compared to the Biden administration, why do we need this huge amount of money going to that as opposed to perhaps some of the other pieces? I could keep going on about the bill itself, but in my remaining time, let me have a 10,000-foot perspective here, because I think there's a bigger political issue with regard to this particular bill, and I'll call it political gimmickry, right? There's been a lot of talk in the media about the fact that the Republicans are doing some gimmicks in order to pass this legislation, not the least of which is the centerpiece of the legislation is the extension of the 2017 tax credits.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is they are ignoring congressional rules by, quote unquote, extending that when it is about to retire. So that the current, quote, policy baseline that the Republicans are going after is problematic. And it's part of a longstanding what I would call political shell game. So reconciliation itself is a shell game, right? These are rules that have been changed over time in order to avoid filibuster. I'd say the nuclear option on federal court appointments, where we go from avoiding the filibuster down to just 50 plus one, and started with Harry Reid and Obama in 2013, and it became a Supreme Court that nuclear option in 2017. That's gimmickry. I'd say executive orders are gimmickry. Joe, this is interesting data. executive orders, as we know, are up in the last 25 years. The Trump one administration is the only administration that increased the number of executive orders over the four-year term. Most presidents do their executive orders early on, and then they decrease over time. Trump 1 increased over time the use of executive orders as a way of sidestepping congressional legislation. Then I'd say the final one that I'll throw out on the table is the shadow docket. So these gimmicks, these changes, these rule changes and so on, the way in which we're sidestepping traditional, conventional policymaking is problematic. And the reality is, as we think about Trump and his disruption and raising of conventions and the traditions that for 200 plus years the presidency abided by, Trump has sort of thrown them out. We have to look at the other branches of government that are also throwing out the conventions and the traditions of the past in order to do their work. And I think it's shameful. It's shameful across the board in all the branches.
So we're going to hold Mike Spain until after the break, and then we'll let you loose. And you can go on this, and then we'll talk more about it. We always welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
I just looked up the endowment tax because I wasn't.
Oh. I said we'll be right back. That's okay. You want us to? You want me?
We
to,
were
to,
right
to,
back.
We can talk it down to 9:30. All right. We're gonna go. reminder: keep your letters short and sweet, and go to. We'll get to them when we get to them. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It's very nice to have you with us again. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have been talking about the third day of deliberations as this tax bill goes looks to move forward. So we have heard from three of our panel members. That leaves Mike Spain. And Mike, what do you think?
Well, I appreciate the 10,000-foot observation, Bo. I think it was really enlightening, and you bring a lot to it. I wanted to go back down at 500 feet again and just watch the votes. I am dovetailing off Jay's comments about Senator Tillis from North Carolina and how just the situation of not being able to run for re-election after you demonstrate some courage and vote your conscience and what it costs you anymore is pretty sad. Everybody's looking at Murkowski. I saw an item where she was in the Senate Majority Leader John Thune's office at 4 a.m. I mean, what kinds of deals are being brokered? And that, and that's just what's going on right now. All these little deals are going on. And who has the... who has the guts, like Tillis now does, to say, I'm going to speak up for my constituents. I'm going to risk my political future. And there's so many senators and so many members of the House of Representatives who are just rationalizing these little compromises that add up to a devastating budget bill. They have no backbone. And they've been rationalizing it, and they're silent on it. There's only a handful of people who are even willing to mildly criticize some things and only doing that to broker some special deal for their home constituents that will, keep them in office, essentially. And it's painful to watch, And Murkowski, I can't imagine how she'll vote for this thing. And Susan Collins of Maine, being another vote, she at least is trying to get a bill through that would remove from this bigger, better, beautiful, whatever it's called, the continuation of the 2017 tax cuts. Because without them, you can't finance any of these other efforts. And yeah, that's not going to go anywhere in this Senate. And then it would go back to the House, and that would never go anywhere. You just have to wonder. And then, you know, what about, you know, we forget that on the other side of the Republican caucus, you have, you know, people like Rick Scott in Florida or Ron Johnson, you know, is it Missouri, or
Wisconsin,
right. Sorry. And I mean, these people are against it for a whole other reason. They want to institute massive restructuring of Medicaid reimbursements to the states that will cut how much money each state gets. And, you know, in the end, what's going to happen is more division, more separation of the way lives are in states. Some states will step up and fill in the blanks a little bit and protect the people who've been cut a little bit. And other states will just accept it as it is. And the devastating inequality of people across the country will only increase, while wealthy people who are well off, who don't need it a bit, are getting a nice big tax cut. It is just appalling.
You know who I'm watching? I'm watching Josh Hawley.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The fact of the matter is the guy talks a mean game, and then when it comes down to it, he pushed it through in the first vote. And I'd be shocked if later today he doesn't vote in favor of it. Putting on my cynical hat, I think, you know, Josh Hawley is the one who talks out of both sides of his mouth.
Sure does.
Of course he does. I try not to think about him. Senator Barrasso and Senator Murkowski, according to Megan Monero at the New York Times, have headed into an elevator. Mm. So we might have a vote this morning while we're chatting about it.
So is the elevator now the back room cigar smoking location?
It used to be the phone booth.
Yeah.
The get smart cone of silence.
I think Chris Coons, somebody had a really important conversation in one of those phone booths.
Yeah. So but is that what does that mean? I mean, I assume that it's
the majority whip told reporters at the Capitol that he expects to vote this morning. And since he was with Senator Murkowski, the insinuation is that he's convinced her. Or that they're convinced.
They're not going to bring it to a vote unless they have the votes, be the convention.
That's what. Where's the elevator going? That's the key question.
Yes, well.
Up or down?
That's a very, very good point. So
Murkowski goes. You still have Collins. You might have Rand Paul. And then you might have the Yahoos, probably not, like Johnson and Rick Scott. You know, they're going to go along for it.
No, the thing, I'll throw this one sentence out there, too. The thing that the press, I don't think, does a good enough job of covering, because it's kind of always in the background, is that the money, the big money in American politics follows Trump. And so as much as, you know, Tom Tillis not running for re-election, as much as these folks want to be able to be independent, they know that their dollars will dry up, or at least a good portion of their dollars will dry up, because the big money supports Trump.
Yeah, because he's willing to extort the system to get them more.
Yeah. Oh, right. But overnight, Elon Musk tweeted out on X that he's ready to pour money into campaigns for people who block this. Now, I don't know whether he'll come through, but I mean, so you have big money against big money. Who's going to win?
See, Elon Musk is so erratic that you can't depend on anything he says today. Go out and form another political party. That's end of the bar, guy doing shots. Kind of talk.
Oh, he's doing more than shots. I mean, ketamine mushrooms, all that.
Yeah. No, but Jay is right. I mean, I find it humorous, the metaphor and the image of him at the end of the bar. But Jay, you're right in light of, in this. And if I'm his political advisor, Elon Musk's political advisor, I don't think he has one.
Nope.
Unless it's ChatGPT.
Job's open.
If I'm his political advisor, I'm shaking him and saying, oh, no, you know, you gave conservatively $400 million, $285 to the president, another, I'm going to say, $115 elsewhere, including that judicial election up in Wisconsin. You gave $400 or $500 million. You can move the needle. Don't start a third party. Just put Republicans up that you support that are sort of Bush Republicans, ones that are more green-centered because he wants the— You put them up against MAGA Republicans in primaries, you're likely that with those amount of dollars to win some of those.
Definitely.
Don't do the third party, which is the death knell of American politics.
So I want to get to letters, but and then the House, right? And then it goes to the House. And we start this little parlor game all over again, right?
Yep.
But yep. Will it be different?
It might be. I mean, it might be that the Tom Tillises who aren't afraid over in the House, the Freedom Caucus folks who are willing to say this doesn't fit my my philosophy in any way, and I am not backing off my philosophy. They may say that what the Senate has done is take a bill that was just barely palatable to them. And they've made it totally unpalatable by adding another $1 trillion or more into the debt. And I think they are going to start. Mike raised a really good point that we hadn't talked about. And I think the Democrats, I don't think, have really hammered this home. They need a simple message. And this is the simple message because it is true. It is well-researched. It is well-documented. It's Trump's old alma mater that did one of the most definitive analyses of what this bill will do to Americans. And what it does to Americans is it takes away money immediately, almost immediately, from the lowest income people. It takes away money from the next level of people. It's a few hundred dollars a year, but to people at that level, you lose a few hundred dollars a year.
You lose your rent. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. At the level that most Americans fall into nowadays, I think the median income of between $50,000 and $93,000, only for 1 year. You get an $800 break altogether. You are $800 ahead in take-home pay. By the second and third and fourth and fifth year, you're losing money. So for all Americans basically earning under $100,000, people are losing. And then it starts to go up quite dramatically. And when you get up to the multi-million dollar income level, you are making $340,000 or $370,000 more a year taking home under this bill. This is a transfer of wealth, and it's obscene.
But it's not on Fox News, so they don't know about
it. They don't know about it. And the Democrats have got to start hammering this home. And if Elon Musk wants to spend some money, God, he could take out every billboard in America and hammer this home.
Is it going to be different, Joe? The answer is no. And the reason is because 60% of all Republicans in Congress have come after 2017. And they know, as I said, they know where the money is. They know that if Trump, especially in the House, right, if Trump goes on Truth Social against them, they will be primaried and they will be out. And the professionalization, as I've talked about before, the professionalization of Congress, these people want to keep their jobs. 60% of them came after Trump. They are sycophants, and at the end of the day, I think Congress is the House of Representatives is an easier win for the MAGA Republicans than the Senate
because they're more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the American people have checked out.
True.
Well, it's 4th of July week. We got a lot of stuff going on.
Second of July.
Bo's already got stuff going on. It's not waiting until the 4th.
I mean, we are only going to have this democracy for so much longer. We might as well
celebrate it. Have an extended party. Or an Irish wake.
Which kind of goes to a point that Mike made before about it. Who made the point about executive orders?
The number of executive orders.
It's why this is happening. I mean, he's got a Senate And he's got a Congress from and a his court. Party. He could pretty much have his own way. I mean, he'd have to compromise a little here and there, but he could have his own way. He does not need all these executive orders. True. So why? So I jotted down a few of the reasons. One is that he's impatient. He just can't stand to wait. He loves the theatrics. He loves being able to sit in the executive office and issue edicts, which is what autocrats do. Like every president before him in modern times, he is expanding the power of the presidency quite happily. And the people around him who, I mean, nobody has command of all the issues and all the energy that Trump appears to have. There's a lot of people around him who are, you know, for all the talk about Joe Biden with the auto pen, there's a lot of people running this government right now, and Donald Trump is simply the front man for
it. So this is an autocrat without an auto pen.
Yeah, kind of.
It's a Sharpie he's got.
Yeah. But I think the other part of it, the big part of it, is the unwillingness of his own party, the people in his own party, the people who know where the money is and everything else, to take any kind of personal responsibility.
Absolutely.
They do not want to be responsible for what Tom Tillis was talking about. They don't want to be in 3 years ago. Say, well, you know, I had some reservations about that bill. I was very concerned about the Medicaid, but Donald Trump promised that it wasn't going to hurt Medicaid, so I voted for it. And I guess I was wrong.
We have a slew of letters, which I like to think of, metaphorically speaking, in the world of radio where it's theater of the mind, that it is our listeners bringing us into their personal elevator. We will open the doors and share it with you when we return after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this first day of July. We are talking about the Trump tax bill, and it's winding its way through the Senate and the votes that are taking place as we speak. As I promised to you, we have letters from our listeners, and let's get to those. Louise says, I am a listener who you said wouldn't be affected by this bill. However, I have a relative living on Social Security. I already supplement her, and this bill will mean I may have to help her even more financially. I can't see how this bill could potentially touch, could not touch every person listening in some indirect way. And that certainly is a good point. I think we all have these touchstones to
totally
to this.
And I completely agree with the listener's comment. I should have qualified that with the people who will be most impacted, right?
Of course, every single American is going to be impacted by this terrible bill.
And if she's living at the on the margin on Social Security, if a relative is supplementing her, there's a good chance there's a fair chance that she's on Medicaid as well. There's a lot of people who are not young
Medicare.
Poor, but yeah. are elderly poor who are also on Medicaid and depending on that. So they're going to be hurt by this. And the other thing is as we pointed out on Sunday is while they are arguing about all this, and while they're doing all this, they're doing nothing about the fact that the Social Security's insolvency date just got pushed
moved
up a year.
Up, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Back or up? I'm never sure. It's a year earlier than we thought. Sooner. And that's a thing for anybody on Social Security who depends on that. You know, a 21% cut in your income? Mm-hmm. That's painful.
It is. Let's go to this letter from Brian, who writes, acting on your show like there's some chance this bill won't pass makes you guys sound naive to the point of a comedy sketch. Well, I think we've made it pretty clear that
part of the problem with American politics right now is the cynicism, and I'm very guilty of that. There are only 5 votes that separate the Democrats and the Republicans in the House, if I'm not mistaken.
Less.
That's not a lot of votes. So, you know, one of the things that's been a problem, Fetterman, a Democrat, was unfortunately quoted, you know, probably out of context, saying he just wanted to go home.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's fortunate. I just think that was great. I want to go home and I want to go to the beach. And
I
we're just sitting here. Everyone knows how I'm going to vote. I want to go home.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And
yeah, the anger was more about, I think, the Republicans than being a senator.
Yes.
But there's an issue with people lacking in engagement unless they can be performative about it or post it somewhere. So, you know, spend time calling the representatives that you can influence as opposed to telling people that it's a done deal, because it just contributes to the lack of engagement politically that we have, civically, really. A lot of people I'm talking to have their heads in the sand from all types of backgrounds and political persuasions.
And I would also mention, in addition to what Sarah is saying, which I agree with, I would also mention that one of the things that's lost a little bit here, even though I totally disagree with everything he generally stands for, is Mike Johnson's a pretty effective speaker, right? And so when you have that margin, that tiny margin, and he was able to get this omnibus bill, right, this mega bill through the House of Representatives, when it happened, I would say to the letter writer, Joe, when it got through the House, it was going to pass. That was the big hurdle early on. Now you just have to work out the details for the Senate and then the House to do it again. But when it originally got through the House, that was the big hurdle.
Let's go to Jay, who has a question for you, Bo. How do we get back to, for all of you, but we'll start with Bo. How do we get back to bipartisan work? Dems seem to start showing support for Republicans that are more willing to work with them and state that the Democrats know they can win just so this Republican doesn't feel like they have to toe the line. What can we do?
Oh, well, I mean, geez, how much time do we have? You know, in my day job, I'm a constitutional reform scholar, right? I spend a lot of time thinking about how to change the Constitution. And ultimately, just in terms of what I was talking about early on with these gimmicks, let's talk about, let's imagine for the moment, because there are changes that Congress makes, whether it's reconciliation or the, as I said, this sort of federal court appointment and confirmation nuclear option. These are changes where the goalpost changes in the middle of the game. I'll give you just one example of how we could make this a better political landscape for us. Any procedural change in Congress has to be approved by two consecutive Congresses, right? So you don't just do it in the moment. You have to have the next Congress do it also. If it's still a majority Republican, good for the Republicans. If it's majority Democrat, good for the Democrats. But you have to get approval by two consecutive Congresses. That would start to bring back some of these traditional conventions and the dignity of the offices that made American politics, you know, racist and unjust for a lot of people, but it made American politics work for 200 plus years.
Jocelyn writes and says, panel.
No.
Please don't waste your time, your breath, your efforts having any kind of sympathy for Senator Lisa Murkowski and the difficult, quote-unquote, position she is in. She is the worst kind of Trump enabler. She's willing to move the line for Trump and her own party's worst elements. In other words, she doesn't draw the line anywhere. Nothing will ever be too bad, too far for her. She will justify, she will rationalize, or simply walk out of the room in silence rather than act with courage or face hard facts. The reality is this bill and Trump's work is an abomination. There would be nothing right about voting for it, but my bet is Lisa Murkowski will vote for it, as will Susan Collins, and yes, those other holdouts.
I don't think she's in the least bit wrong.
Nope. I think we all agree on that.
I think we've seen the Murkowski show over and over and over, and maybe in whatever fairness I can come up with for her, she sincerely is negotiating, fully understanding that she's going to concede at the end, but she's going to get as much as she can out of it. That may be the best I can say about Lisa Murkowski, but she is always, my wife always, she's one of those people that holds out hope. You know, she, oh, look, Lisa Murkowski's holding out. And I'm like, oh, God, really?
Yeah.
For the people of Alaska.
Yeah. I mean, we've had like a 6-year running joke on the show of like, oh, it's Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. We're going to wait for
typically around Supreme Court.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Oh, we're going to be, we're all good.
Could I?
Yes.
So you're talking about procedural changes.
Mm-hmm.
There have been calls, and I only hear them on the right, for a constitutional convention.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it just, in this day and age, is a dangerous proposition to open that document up for that, but
you know that, I mean,
maybe that's a whole other show.
No, we should have a whole other show on it. You know, this is my
Bo just wrote his own. Right. He's got it in his pocket. He's ready to go.
Jay, we can talk about this some other time, but ultimately, when you get enough people in the room and a right representation in the room, South Africa is a great example. If you get enough people in the room in the metaphorical Independence Hall in Philadelphia, everybody mm-hmm. should go. And the right people, and there are ways you can do that. What you'll see is that a constitution written by a group of 21st century folks will gravitate to the middle. It'll be a small C conservative constitution, mm-hmm. and where the battles will be about rights, environmental rights, rights to health care, rights to affordable housing, and so on. I think we can manage those. But basically, other than that, it's not going to be as radically different. And we need an update on the Constitution.
It's really different. But that tracks with, I'm sure you know, the European Union experiment and Charlemagne and the Constitution drafting. Mm. It was all rights.
Yeah. It's going to be about rights.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will have a few more letters, and then we're going to move on to other subjects. It'll be a gentle transition, as a lot of these are intertwined. So we will take a break, and we'll continue with our terrific panel right after this.
Yes, I'm grown now.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It's the 1st of July, and it's 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. And we have a fantastic panel assembled. Bo Breslin is here, Joseph Palamountain, Junior Chair in Government at Skidmore College, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about the tax bill and its the GOP machinations. And I just have a couple of letters. We didn't get to all of them that originally had been pulled. So let me just get to those, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Let's see. We go to Maxine. I do not find that people are checking out or that the Dems deserve the negativity the media and the panel distributes. Those I speak with in my neighborhood of Saratoga County and beyond are weathering the storm and doing what they can as citizens. And I see Dems speaking out continually. Perhaps the panel and national media should pay attention to those of us on the corners, meaning the corners of the streets mm-hmm. or block. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's been some articulate. I'm sorry, Sarah.
No, go ahead.
Just some really articulate comments from, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Senator Murphy has been really outspoken. I mean, and there's lots others, who have, kind of inspired, I think, a lot of people to pay attention to this. But it's does seem like it's going upstream against a Niagara Falls,
Yeah, but there are lots of indivisible groups. I mean, the No Kings protests were massive and were well covered, and I think that was hailed as one of the largest nationwide protests in modern American political history. This was a complaint in 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019 as well, just because the Trump machine and its cronies and the media outlets it has purchased are really good at distracting and diverting attention. So all of these things can be true at once. The point is it's not working in terms of this particular political moment, because for lots of reasons, including that tax bills are not as exciting as protests. That's just, at least my impression of engagement. So there are lots of different factors going on here, and everyone should feel, I think, a civic obligation to interact with government in between elections. I guess I'll just put it that way. I just don't see it happening at the rate that it needs to in order for us to move past the moment we're in.
And let me, I'll quickly thank the listener for the civic engagement that happens on the corner and so on. I'm curious, as a lifelong Democrat, I'm curious how the Democratic Party actually ultimately deals with Mondami, right? So to me, at this point, the Democrats are so busy trying to avoid steering too far left that we still don't have a message. And we need a message, and Mondami is providing us with an urgent moment to come up with a message. Let's see if we can come up with one.
And some awfully cool stuff. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's the kind of thing that people on the left used to talk about more in the center of the left, or a little to the left of the left of the center. The idea that, you got a city of billionaires, this really rich people in New York, and Mondami's basically saying, look, we have an affordable housing crisis in this city. We have a quality of life crisis in this city because so many people are just barely affording to live here. Let's put a little more tax on the rich and pay for some real affordable housing. What's so bad about the idea of free public transportation? Wow. Mm-hmm. What an out, for this moment, for this government, for this state of mind, out of the box. But why not? It's what is it up to in New York? $2.50 now to ride a subway? We were just looking at subway tokens the other day. I remember when they were a quarter or a dime or something like that. $2.50 every time you get in take a ride somewhere. That's taxi rates from my ancient days.
No.
All right. Well, maybe it wasn't that much. But it was.
Taxis can be pricey.
Well, nowadays, yeah.
Yes.
But
yes.
Back then, it was, mile, or
absolutely.
The first quarter mile. And then
you're dating yourself, Jay.
Yes, I am really dating myself.
All right, and I thought there was one more here. David said, we all know of the perils of Republicans voting against their king, hence the verb to get primaried. That action is freely stated as though there's nothing inherently corrupt about it, but what about the even darker, less publicized scenario of having their lives and or lives of their loved ones threatened? How much of that is going on at present?
That's a really important question to ask in this era of political violence. There's a documented, really well-established increase of political violence in the United States. And that's not just coming from the Trump administration. That's coming from a lot of different pockets in the country.
So let's talk about, just for a moment, of the decision by Representative Don Bacon and Senator Tom Tillis of looking for the door of saying they won't seek re-election, and this going into just that last letter. What does that mean? Because I mean, I understand it. Like you're just like, well, what am I doing this for? And there's got to be an easier way to make a living. If you really are a good representative and you're out for the best of the people, of saying, well, I can't even accomplish that in this with this current set of rules, well, yeah.
I think in part it goes back to what we just touched on.
Call me a dollar fifty cab.
And it's not a dollar fifty cab. it's the violence, I think, in part, that we just touched on as well. I think that, it's one thing to take a stand, and it's another thing to be sure that a lot of people are going to vote for you. But it's a whole other thing to think there's going to be violence against me. I mean, you torched a governor's mansion in Pennsylvania, and you think you're safe, and in some wherever Bacon is from in Nebraska, I believe, or Tillis is from in North Carolina. That would be the thing that would keep me out of politics if I was in it. When I look at Tillis and I look at what he said, it's like, if I was a person who had waged battles to get myself through politics to this level of politics, to the greatest deliberative body in the world, it takes a fighter to get there. Mm-hmm. And, you want to take on Donald Trump? I could just see him going, yeah, I'll take on Donald Trump, but you got to take on all the people, all the crazies. Who are going to take a shot at you?
Yeah,
and I think that's a real thing that people are afraid of.
I think the complexity of governing, especially in Washington, is exponentially different than it was pre 9/11. I'll say, and that's not that long ago, right? So, in those days, there was collaboration across the aisle. There was conversation. You think of Tip O'Neill and so on, sort of the major players that a lot of us grew up with thinking about. And really, the ideological spectrum was linear, right? It was right versus left, liberal versus conservative. Now you're adding multi-dimensions to it, so that now it's not just liberal versus conservative, it's also institutional maintenance versus institutional disruptor, right? So you have to play multiple roles if you are a politician in Washington, and you have to think multi-dimensionally. That, I think, is exhausting. The thing that's probably most surprising about Tom Tillis is he's only a two-time senator, and he's given up, right? He's said he's thrown in the towel, not just because Trump, and there is speculation that Tillis didn't love the job to begin with. So I'm not surprised that he's leaving. But usually it's the people who have been there a long time who see it differently and now say, it's not the Senate I once knew. We're getting now folks who just are exhausted early on because of how complex governing is in Washington.
Well, there's fear, and then the flip side of that is love. And there, I'm going to say something really patriotic. You see some of these younger electeds surviving the storm, weathering the storm, and continuing to speak out, in part because they make certain life choices with their family to negotiate the fear piece of it. But in large part because they are, for lack of a better term, in it for the right reasons. You have Pat Ryan, who's really, I remember working with him as a county executive not that long ago, reclaiming the American flag. Alyssa Slotkin, who's now the Michigan senator, pointing out to Pete Hegseth, looking at him face to face, how ridiculous a lot of his policies are for service members in our country. And there's a really smart thing there happening where Democrats are saying, yeah, everybody's sick of politics and politicians, except, we're not going to be the standard politicians. We're not going to be the politicians that are walking out the door who really believed in the system that we have that's not working anymore. We're going to look at a different system. It's not going to be that much different. So it's not scary different, but it's going to be a return. And we'll see if that works. The Democrats have paid a lot of people a lot of money, I think, to try to figure out what works. And I think this younger class of lawmakers is figuring out through trial and error, through authenticity, by refusing to give up. Cory Booker, of course, another one of those. Just constantly sticking with the program, even when we know that we're going to lose this vote, we Democrats.
Well, let me ask you, Sarah, a follow-up question, and that is, Cory Booker is a great case study in you know, the future of Democratic politics. And by Democratic, I'm talking big D Democratic politics. He ran on a platform of joy, much like Mondami did, right? But he couldn't get it off the ground.
Because of Biden.
Because of Biden. And, right, there were all sorts of factors that play a role. Is there a future for the Cory Booker of the world? Wes Moore is another guy who kind of in that same mold, a governor of Maryland. Is there a future for a national politician at the presidential level campaigning on the politics of joy? I hope so. I'm not sure, though.
I saw Cory recently at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City did a 20th anniversary screening of the documentary Street Fight, which was about his first campaign, which in full disclosure, I worked on. I worked on his second campaign for mayor, too. And I vowed not to leave the city of Newark until he won. And the day he won, I left. So not that day, but shortly thereafter. So I've been studying his career for a long time and am 100,000% biased. But when he was answering questions from the audience, I mean, first of all, it was packed. It was in the middle of the day on like a Thursday, I think it was. Members of the 2002 campaign, which I was a part of, like 15 of us within 48 hours planned to be there. Like none of us really. Marshall Curry, the director, has stuck with Corey's story for a long time. He is a magnet for people who authentically are concerned and care about the future of the country, and not a lot of politicians can pull that off. Yeah. And he is who he says he is. He's not anybody.
And I'm hopeful.
People just keep waiting for that to explode, and it never will, I promise.
All right, we have a few minutes here. Let's go to other things that are making news, and we welcome you and your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So the other thing, and we can, I think this is may take a little bit longer than the 6 minutes that we have, but that's okay. We can bring it over to after the break. But the interesting story in Rolling Stone that says that Team Trump is serious about unleashing the Espionage Act on the media. And I thought since we had some media types here, this may be a good story to talk about. Donald Trump hates leakers. He isn't a fan of journalists either. He wants to punish them both in response to reporting that early Pentagon intelligence found the administration's recent strikes against Iran weren't as effective as the president had been claiming. They should be prosecuted, he said. And he said this on Maria Bartiromo's show. This was on Fox News. And so the question is, the idea would be to prosecute journalists using this arcane rule for something that, A, you disagree with, B, you don't find is that the president wouldn't find perhaps as truthful, or just doesn't like it. What are the chances, Mike?
Well, presidents have been trying to outdo or undermine or somehow get around media coverage and any kind of watchdog approach the media takes on them going way back. I remember Nixon tried to go around the media, the national media, by going directly to local media. And he tried to undermine the media in the 80s. It happened. The media had been very successful in keeping administrations at least exposed to what was going, scrutiny. And what really happened was the media now is because of the internet, the media is completely diversified, and certainly it's weak. You know, it's easier to go after the media because it doesn't have the sort of unique protection of powerful money-making that it made for its investors, and the investors now are getting wobbly. I mean, and you know, this is all happening. You know, Trump is going after the media a lot of different ways. He's reportedly, the New York Times says, in negotiations for a settlement with Paramount over a 60 Minutes program where he claimed that 60 Minutes edited Kamala Harris's interview in a way that was very favorable for her and was unfair. And they're ready to fork over perhaps millions of dollars the way ABC did over a misstatement that George Stephanopoulos apologized for, which was just a very slight misstatement that was completely defensible and would have been defended in another era, I think. So, you know, it's a very vulnerable time for the media and the diversification of the media and the availability of all kinds of different media. It's a tough time to know where to turn and who to trust, and they're capitalizing on that.
According to this article in the Rolling Stone, the president's lieutenants are listening to Trump, and per the administration, officials are looking for the right case to launch their, quote, maiden voyage of an unprecedented type of espionage act prosecution, one which would also serve to broadly intimidate news organizations when it comes to publishing classified government information or protecting the identities of their confidential sources.
So the first thing I think that story is going to prompt is a bit of training refreshers for at newspaper. You know, any responsible newspaper is always, you know, sending out notes to reporters, reminders occasionally of, you know, here are your obligations, here are your responsibilities, here's how you do things from day to day. I mean, this isn't a constant flow of stuff, but every once in a while you get a note that says, reminder, when you are dealing with a source, here are the things you need to remember, or something like that. They are looking, and the story goes into it, they're looking for someone to make one single mistake that you behave completely above board and you say one wrong thing and somehow they get that on the record. They find that it's on the record. Could you steal this document for me?
Or I need to see this document in order to prove what you're telling me.
Right. Yeah. And there's a way to say that and there's a way not to say that.
Right.
What proof do you have of what you're telling me? That's a perfectly journalistic thing to say. Could you just pull that document out of the file and show it to me? That's a different thing. So, you know, we know that they're going to do this. The thing's going to be, and it's going to be interesting because we've seen a few cases over the years where reporters didn't want to reveal their sources and were willing to go to jail for it. And I think that courage exists on the front lines in journalism. I think every reporter who has ever thought about this has said, if I have to go to jail for a period of time, as long as they keep my paycheck coming and my family, you know, I can make the mortgage and my family has a roof over their head, we're good. I think the cowardice and the compromise is at the corporate level, and it, and unfortunately we have a lot of individual people who don't have the courage, or you know, for all his faults, you know, don't have the courage for William Randolph Hearst, who would stand up to something like that. You've got the cowardice of, and I can't remember her name, but the person at Paramount,
Sherry Redstone,
who wants a deal. To sell, I think, and if she gets that deal, then she's going to be that much richer. She's going to be that much more of a billionaire than she already is, and you know the cost of that, the cost of backing off and saying this whining nonsense that Trump doesn't like the way a show was edited. It's going to get thrown out of court, but she doesn't want to have that fight because the FCC is going to because he controls the FCC, and that could tank her deal. That's a terrible situation to be in. I would argue it's an impeachable offense to it's blackmail to threaten that you're going to use your power of government to tank a corporate deal so that you can get an apology out of someone for a First Amendment right. I mean, there's a path there. that leads to what I consider to be an impeachable offense. But I think everything he does from day to day
is the damage
offense.
Will be 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
An institution that may just end.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion, hear from our other panelists on it, and we'll wrap up our overall conversation on this Tuesday morning. We'll be right back. While Bobby's just sitting alone at the bar. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are at the moment talking about President Trump discussing cracking down on leakers and the media, the press, in wielding the Espionage Act, a 1917 law criminalizing the dissemination of sensitive information that could harm U.S. national security or aid a foreign nation. We heard from both Mike and Jay. Bo.
Yeah, so I'm going to thank you to Mike and Jay for enlightening us about the journalistic angle, the press angle. I'm going to take a little bit of a different stand, and maybe Sarah and I can riff back and forth about the law. So stories matter, and history matters. And what's troubling for me is the fact that the Espionage Act of 1917 is, in some ways, a centerpiece, a Mount Rushmore of our struggle with the First Amendment. And so there were a series of cases in 1919, and I'm not going to bore the listeners with them, but they're Schenck, Froehrich, Debs, and then Abrams, in which Justice Holmes and Justice Brandeis evolved our notion of the right to free speech. These were challenges to the Espionage Act of 1917. Now it's back again. And by the end of those series of cases, Holmes and Brandeis, the great defenders of the right to free speech, had suggested that the Espionage Act was unconstitutional and that in certain situations and not applied. That said, that story is a centerpiece of our evolution in the right to free speech. That Espionage Act, much like some of the great cases in the 20th century, Brown versus the Board of Education and so on, are anchors into the liberty that America should be rightly proud of. And so do you think anybody in the Trump administration understands the story of the Espionage Act being the key moment in which Brandeis and Holmes were able to, articulate the beauty of the right to free speech? I'm not sure they do.
I can't get my buzzer to work. I was going to right get in there with my perspective.
They only need to delay for so long. I mean, the Trump administration folks, right? They need to get 3 more years of misinformation out there. They need to be able to wrangle and distort the press in any way that they can. And now that we've got our national injunction ruling, it'll be a lot harder to protect, especially probably, and I defer to the journalists among us, but like mid-size and small news outlets, which is where the vast majority of people are getting their day-to-day, about the tragic car accident in Westerlo yesterday, or, what's happening in your backyard. And how you feel about it.
Yeah, we're not a Times Union isn't like a Watertown Times, which is the last paper I worked for, which is a family-owned paper, small. They have to weigh every legal fight that they're going to have.
Put them out of business.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lawsuit could put them out of business.
As opposed to the Hearst Corporation, which can say, well, all right, we'll take some money from House Beautiful or Cosmo or something, or I guess we'll have a few less nice lunches at the Tower, and we'll help the Times Union survive.
Pay the lawyers.
And there was a time when the court was protective of the right to free press, right to free speech. You can't rely on the court anymore, and so as a result, I fear for all levels of journalism.
Their deference to the president is the scariest part of this. That if the president comes in and says this is a matter of national security, and they say this was about some party squabble you're having with some leaders over at the House, how is that national security? Right. Well, we're not at liberty to say, but it's national security, and the president says so. And the I want to say Scalia.
Yeah. Thomas Alito?
Alito.
Yeah.
Alito.
No, I mean,
Alito.
Thomas has been
looking for us.
You know, find a way to, you know, bring up Times versus Sullivan and reverse that.
Ever since he's been on the bench.
You know?
Well, and I think we were talking about it during the break. There's an issue of self-censorship that happens. And of course, that's like classic. Like, that's what happens when you enter into a tyrannical period of time, is that people start being very careful about what they say through any public medium at all for fear of the bringing the wrath of the federal government upon them.
The chilling effect is real. And it's worse today than in my entire lifetime.
And it is all the threat of something else, that the power of government is going to hurt you in other ways. And I think that's why the law firms, so many of the law firms caved when they knew they had a good case against him. But they caved because they were going to lose federal
business. It was the bottom line.
I read something interesting the other day, Joe, that one of the reasons why – there are multiple reasons why Trump goes after these – what I would say these sort of cultural iconic institutions, whether they be – the press or the universities or NPR, PBS, and, you know, these cultural, sure, they tend to be housed largely by those on the left. That's one reason. But the other reason, which I thought was super fascinating, is that those are the places and the institutions that tend to promote democracy. There are places in which we get together. There are places in which we think about democracy in ways like on this radio station or on our university campuses or in other settings. They tend to be places in which democracy is prioritized and conversations happen about democratic progress. And so he's not only attacking cultural institutions like the Kennedy Center and so on because of the fact that they're occupied or owned by left-wing folks, but because of the fact that they are small, democratic havens.
This is an aside, but I'm always looking for rays of hope. And the Kennedy Center discussion I read an article where there were some drag queens that went to the Kennedy Center honors where the President Trump and Melania were. And they.
Yeah, for he was going to see Les Miserables, I believe.
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
And yeah. And so pretty classic, you know, and they. Went in expecting, you know, maybe to be targeted or to, you know.
Lovely night out in the theater about the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Right, that's all.
That's very prescient and felt in our bodies currently. But
Maria Antoinette was treated so unfairly.
I like the Trump hand that you did there. people, I wanted the listeners to be able to appreciate that too. But they interviewed the drag queens on the way out of the performance, and they said actually we had a lot of really great conversations with people who deeply disagreed with us. And I thought, well, that's a nice story.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I think we're at a point where we're all so fed up and exhausted of fighting. It's sort of the point, the part of the family gathering where everybody's just too tired and full to fight anymore. And everybody just, I don't know, watches football or goes into the backyard or finds another room to exist in. And that's maybe where we are. But everybody agrees to kind of try to work together to figure it out going forward. And hopefully that's as best I can get to a celebration this 4th.
Robert Putnam was right. We are bowling alone in part because we're exhausted and we can't fathom the idea of talking across difference these days.
We're getting deep. Okay. It's good. I like it.
I think we should also mention, if we're sort of moving along here, the USAID, Agency for International Development.
Yeah.
Yesterday, their swath of employees that were laid off by DOGE had their last day. And three different people came out publicly to praise them. Barack Obama, not a surprise. George W. Bush, of course, for all the work they've done and that he's supported against to fight AIDS in Africa and around the globe. And Bono.
Yeah,
you too.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't really help, as far as I can tell, in terms of public opinion. And I don't
have
anything against Bono.
I'm thrilled at Bono. Right.
That's where he would be. It's just that is a, you know, that's a vestige of the 80s and 90s in terms of signaling that doesn't resonate anymore.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. A vestige. Let's see. We have about 5 minutes. So let's real quick talk about Canada's tax U-turn, which, as the New York Times reports, highlights the Trump tariff tactics. I love alliteration in literature. In journalism, it's just great. After President Trump suspended trade talks with Canada over its controversial digital services tax, Ottawa scrapped it to get back to the negotiating table. It was an about-face amid trade negotiations with the U.S., and it was welcomed by the Trump administration as a victory. But for the Canadian government, it may have just been a calculated tactical retreat. On Friday, President Trump said he was suspending trade talks because Canada was about to start collecting a tax on big American technology companies, a levy that he has criticized as a blatant attack. On Sunday evening, hours before that tax came into effect, the Canadian government announced it was scrapping it. The Prime Minister, Mark Carney of Canada, said the decision was meant to allow the resumption of trade talks with the United States of America. On Monday morning, talks were back on, but the White House did not miss the opportunity to take a victory lap. What does this mean, Bo?
Okay, so I've lost my job as Elon Musk's political strategist, and now I'm Mark Carney's political strategist. I don't understand, Joe, why we're Canada, or any country for that matter, is floating these. If you're going to retreat from tariffs on American technology or goods, if you're eventually going to retreat, why give Trump the victory? Because he's incredibly emboldened by the victories coming from within, whether they be the Supreme Court or Congress or the people around him. How is it possible that Mark Carney, a super smart guy, didn't see that this was going to be, when they retreated from that this was going to be a Trump victory that actually diminishes Canada's independence and authority? So as a strategist, if I'm talking to leaders around the world, if you're going to buckle, don't put it out there to begin with. That's what that's the argument I would make.
Yeah, but this this tax was enacted last year before Trump was in office.
It was Trudeau, so it was really a Trudeau tax.
I'm talking about messaging.
Well, I mean, I think it underscores how poor the message is. I mean, this was something that really was a thing. It wasn't something that they were just doing as a tit for tat. And it was, and they hadn't collected it yet, but it was going to kick into effect. And I mean, I think it's a big cave by Canada, and it does not look good. I agree with you.
The only upside of it I can see is that it was a very public concession that was not actually a concession by Carney. I mean, it wasn't a concession of something he was attached to. It was something that Trudeau had done.
Correct.
It was put in place. It was scheduled. It was going to happen. And in a very big way, Carney said, you know what? We're not going to do that. We're going to give you something. Now the only thing left for Trump is to give them something back. And because it's been very public, everybody knows this wasn't something that took place behind closed doors or in an elevator. it was out there in public. Canada has given them something, and the whole world's going to say, "Well, gosh, Canada deserves something now too, doesn't it?" And that's what they get.
So
to
it's
sit
the
down
public
the
theater that supports this back and forth. Yeah. You scratch my back, I'll scratch
and
yours.
And they've given Trump what he loves, which is something to brag about.
Well, Columbia University and Paul Weiss and other law firms are still looking for that payback.
The tax. Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened.
No, I was wondering, like, what are the countries that are going to tell the United States they have to do anything in terms of, like, a tat?
And when do all the when does the date kick in? July 9th, when all the tariffs are going to kick in now? Unless Taco.
Right. Taco.
And Scott Bessent does come out and say, well, that's a flexible date.
All right. With that said, we'll put a put a pause on it at that point. My thanks to everybody for being with us. Bo Breslin, Jay Jochnowitz, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain. You're all wonderful. I appreciate you being here. Thank you very much for your expertise and brilliance in talking about these issues this morning. And have a beautiful holiday weekend. We will be back right after this.